So I'm going to tell you a story about me, and I'm wondering if you, as you are listening, can think about a time that it might have equally applied to you. All right? Deal? Okay. So I was in seminary, and grad school was a little bit stressful for me. I had a lot of classes. I was living in a new country. I was trying to figure everything out. And so at times, my stress got the better at me. Now, all of us have different ways of dealing with stress, some of them healthy, some of them not so healthy. And one of the habits that I started to develop, just unconsciously at first, was that every time I was stressed, I would go and buy a Diet Coke. Anyone of you relate to that? Right? So you had a really stressful day at school, you found yourself at the convenience store, you'd grab a Diet Coke, you'd walk down, start to feel good. One day in my last year of seminary, I realized that I had gotten off the train after my half an hour commute. I had exited the subway, and suddenly I had a Diet Coke in my hand. I looked at the clock. It was 7:45 a.m. I realized also that I didn't want to have a Diet Coke in that moment, but somehow I had entered the subway without one, and I had somehow left with one. I didn't want to drink it. I didn't want to open the cap and have that satisfying noise. None of it appealed to me. So why had I bought one? I entered the subway without it, and yet suddenly it was here. Any of you relate to that? They say it takes 21 repetitions for the possibility of a new behavior to be born. 300 repetitions for that behavior to become muscle memory, that we can enact the correct movement, technique, or conversation by memory. 3,000 repetitions before we can embody a new practice. Somatics teacher LaWanda H. Thompson teaches that embodiment means that under pressure, we won't revert back to the old pattern. 21 repetitions for the possibility of a new behavior, 300 repetitions before it becomes muscle memory, 3,000 repetitions before we can embody it and then under stress not go back. We form habits as humans, but it is probably more the case that our habits form us. What we practice, we get really great at. Now, it wasn't the first time that I realized that I had an association between eating and stress. In college, I would go to our local campus convenience store when I was very stressed, usually around exams and finals, and I would buy two seemingly contradictory items. I would buy a case of double-stuffed Oreos and a big 2-liter bottle of orange juice. I know. I think it was because both of these items I didn't have growing up. We were not an orange juice type family. We were the family that would get the concentrated orange juice and then dilute it to the point that you couldn't even taste the orange in it. So the idea of having Tropicana fresh was quite alluring. Now, in many ways, emotional eating, which is what this is, that when we feel stressed, some of us go to eat, it makes complete sense. Biologically, neurologically, food is pleasurable. Feeling stressed isn't. Eating can help us avoid some of those feelings that we don't want to eat or we don't want to feel through eating. The thing about emotional eating, though, is it has a lot of mindlessness to it. I have a graph that I want to show you. This is a graph of the Oreo Pleasure Index. So as you can see, as the number of Oreos that you consume in one sitting increases, the amount of pleasure that you have actually goes down quite substantially. You probably can't tell, but this is the zero line. That after about 5 Oreos, you don't really taste very good. And yet somehow I can eat more than 8 Oreos in one sitting. It usually has to do with the fact that I don't really realize it's happening, right? There's a mindlessness to it. there's an excess, that there's an indulgence that goes beyond the point of pleasure, that it's hard sometimes to find that place of enough. 21 times for a new behavior to be possible, 300 times for it to be muscle memory, 3,000 times for it to become embodied. This series that we're in right now, these collections of worships, we're exploring the good life. And the tagline that we have for this is that the good life feels good. The good life feels good now, and it feels good tomorrow. One of the things I realized as I would consume the Oreos and the OJ is that it would start to feel good at the beginning, but after all of it, it started to feel less good. And the next day, it felt even worse. This series is all about pleasure, which is not something you generally think to hear about in church, especially pleasure as a positive thing. We're pro-pleasure here. We think pleasure's good. So we've been rewriting the script of society. We've been rewriting the script that tells us that pleasure is shameful, that our desires are bad, that it is sinful to experience pleasure or joy in this moment because so much is broken in the world. Why should we feel good? That if it feels good, it might be wrong. All of these stories that exist in our society, we're trying to rewrite them. As an aside, did you know that Kellogg's cornflakes were developed to decrease sexual desire? They thought that if you ate a really bland cereal, it wouldn't excite you. That is the level to which our society is anti-pleasure, that we devise breakfast cereals to stop it. All right. So this series, we're trying to recalibrate ourselves from these stories that tell us that pleasure is not a good thing to these stories that say that feeling good is actually the compass for the good life. That feeling good is actually the compass for the good life. That it is both the pathway and the destination. We're asking questions like, what if every meeting or gathering we went to at work, at home, in our community, in our church, was filled with tasty food or rich relationships that can withstand disagreement or commitments to joy and fun? What would that world look like if we truly said that feeling good is the way and the destination? It is a series in which we have said that your body deserves to feel good, that it is worthy no matter its age, ability, racialized identity, or sexual or gender expression. And so my question to you, as we're in the depths of this series and talking about pleasure, my question is, what futures are the habits of pleasure that you embody right now? What future are those habits forming for you? What does that future look like? Said another way, who are your habits forming you to be? And I invite you to take an honest look right now at your life, at the good parts, the parts that you've been working at, striving at, the ways that you've been trying to build that space of self-love and care into your life, but also maybe to look at the parts that you don't like looking at. Because even if you don't like looking at them, they're still forming you nonetheless. 21 times for a new habit, 300 times for muscle memory, 3,000 times for embodiment. What future are your habits of pleasure forming for you? Is it a future of pleasure sustained over a long time, of joy, of connection in deep relationships with your body, with others, with your family members? Is it habits of depth, or is it habits of secrets or pain or disconnection or shallowness or excess? For the habits of pleasure are important. We can use them to cover up pain or embrace the truth of life's joy. And now, as soon as I ask this question, I can hear whispers of that old story start to creep in, right? As soon as we talk about the habits of pleasure and some of them covering up pain, the stories from that old story come in and say, see? You can't trust pleasure. It's just about denying something. It leads you down the wrong path. Abort, abort. Life is actually pain and drudgery. Get ready for it. But that's not what I'm saying at all. What I am saying and inviting you into is that the good life feels good now and tomorrow and next year. That the habits of pleasure are not simply momentary, but lifelong. That deepening relationships are not always easy and pleasurable. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
And yet, in the long run, they are so satisfying. To have someone there for you, even when you are not your best self, who can help you become that person that you dream to be, that only happens if you have a deep relationship. That pleasure of that connection only happens when you have a deep relationship. Getting to know our bodies that are constantly changing is a lifelong pursuit. Exercise and other movements that strengthen the body don't always feel good at the beginning or even during it, and yet feel good in the long run. And so as we come of age, as writer Adrienne Marie Brown says, what we pay attention to, what we give our hearts to, tends to grow. So the question is, to what are you giving your heart, and how and who is that forming you to be? We right now live in a time of complete instant gratification. I mean, it used to be, I have a foggy memory of this. It used to be that TV shows only released one episode a week. Do you remember that? I think only antiquated shows that are invoking nostalgia like Game of Thrones do that right now. It used to be that we couldn't watch a whole series on Netflix with the click of a button. It used to be that we couldn't get something delivered from across the country in 2 days or less. It used to be that we couldn't access a repository of information the world over in but a second. Scientists at the University of Amherst have found that for every second of delay when watching a video on YouTube, you lose 5.8% of your audience. So by 40 seconds, about a third of the audience is gone. So as you're watching a video, if there's that lag, that buffering, for every time it's slow, you get to that point, 40 seconds, a third of us are gone. We live in a society that tells us to be gratified in this moment and that it can be delivered to our door. Now, it was interesting. I was doing research about instant gratification, and there's a lot of vilification of it. And if you look at the peer-reviewed scientific data, there's actually not a kind of comprehensive understanding of what this is doing to our society. In fact, it seems more like a Rorschach test. You know, each person looks at it and what their conceptions of this get mirrored back when they look at this. But as I've been thinking about this, I've realized that my relationship to instant gratification and pleasure is much like my relationship to instant mashed potatoes. That I think it's going to be amazing. And then it's not. But I keep eating just to see if it in fact gets better. In fact, scientists have said that when you order something online, you experience the most pleasure between the point you click order and it being delivered. Anticipation is actually what creates desire and pleasure for many of us. And so where do we go? What are our next steps? I can tell you that we have two pathways. The first is to truly embrace pleasure. Adrienne Marie Brown invites us to engage in practices that we're passionate about, that are pleasurable, to build up our habits. That if we are passionate about a practice, we can, that it's relevant to our lives, to the lives we want to create, we're going to be more likely to build those habits. It's why they sometimes invite you to pair two stimuli together, that if you don't like exercise, but you really like smoothies, you promise yourself a smoothie after your exercise, that you bundle together, or as one researcher says, dopamize it, which is that pleasure hormone, that we somehow need to build habits for future pleasure by following our current ones. The other avenue for us to explore is to learn what it feels to be satiated, to experience enough. Many of us are so disconnected from our sense of pleasure and joy that we go to extremes once we're unleashed or invited into it. We don't just eat one cookie, we eat 17, even though one would be enough. I was in a course in seminary on intuitive eating. This was a mindfulness-based program that invited you to have a different relationship with food. And one of the things they did was they invited us to and gave us permission to emotionally eat. They said, if you are feeling stressed and a Snickers bar would make you feel better, go and buy a Snickers bar and then look at the Snickers bar and say, I'm feeling sad. You're going to make me feel better. I'm going to emotionally eat you. Now, it seems silly, but what it did is it decreased the shame and it decreased the mindlessness of it. It was intentional. What I found is that you would just eat one, that one was enough once you were mindful of what that feeling of what enough felt like. It started to retrain me to feel that sense of satiation, which is between empty and stuffed. In between. Just enough. Our habits form us more than we form our habits. What is the future that your habits of pleasure are setting up for you today? I hope it is one of a good life that feels good tomorrow, next year, and for every day of your life. Amen.